The title of this session is Violence Pays, So Do You.
I'd like to start out with a word of prayer.
O God, who cares about even the sparrow, help me to care as passionately about you and your entire creation. Fill us with the awe and wonder of what you have made, and to be always willing to bring your word of hope and peace to others. In Jesus' name, amen.
Well, since a lot of you weren't here the very first time we talked about parish nursing, I would like to just say that Judy Anderson, who is the president of the board of Northwest Parish Nurse Ministries, and I, and I'm the coordinator, we've come to Holden to tell people about parish nursing, and we kind of covered that on Monday. And just to give you a little example, I think this says it so nicely about what we are all about. David Hilton, who was a missionary in Nigeria, was noticing that as much as he kept fixing people up, there were just as many sick people when he finished. And so he thought, there's got to be a better way to do this. So what he said is that that the people's living conditions which caused the diseases did not change. With community developers, he worked with the people to help them realize how they could do something about their health. And basically, that's what parish nurses are doing, is they are meeting with the pastor, the staff members of the church, to talk about how we can all be doing something about our health. And Dr. Hilton identified certain things that he was seeing in this country. First of all, that 80% of all illnesses in the United States are preventable. He identified violence, particularly murder, as an epidemic involving well-being that is not addressed. The continued use and promotion of tobacco he called the number one destroyer of the century. Health involves the basic problems of life, he said. Thus, it is the responsibility and challenge of the church to lead the way in healing, for it has the resources. It is a place of healing. So, part of what parish nurses do is to help the congregation become aware of what is happening. And so, one of the reasons that we are addressing violence is because violence will be the number one killer in the United States by the year 2010. It already is the number one killer in many instances in the age group between 15 and 24 of young black males. And it's getting that way so that it's also number one with white males. And I think I was just going through, are any of you familiar with Al Rognes? Mm-hmm. This is the word for every day, and I think it's significant that 15 years ago, he wrote a devotion called The Thirst for Violence. And he says, a well-traveled friend of mine said, you can walk the streets of Calcutta at night without fear, but not the streets of Detroit or New York. It's a disturbing fact that the past quarter of a century has vastly increased the phenomenon of violence in our country. But he always also goes on to say this, and this is really the word that we need to be taking back to our churches. In every age of violence, there have been followers of Christ who resisted the tide. Some of them were swept away, but others survived in the midst of chaos to keep alive and nourish the fruits of the Spirit. Love, tenderness, kindness, hope, self-control. The wheels of God grind slowly, but throughout the centuries, his mercy and courage has again and again eroded the power of hatred, greed, and lust. However feeble at the moment are the signs that recovery is underway, we must cling to the hope, and in our own families, schools, and communities, we must be vigilant to exalt the way of Christ as the only way that can bring joy and meaning into a harried world.
What's the date?
This one is November 7th.
What?
November 7th. Yeah, I find he always, but I think 15 years ago he was writing this. And 2 years ago, Jim Wallace, if you're familiar with Sojourners magazine, he wrote this. A young man fleeing two pursuers with automatic weapons ducks into a church during a worship service, believing he will be safe there. His assailants don't even pause at the church door as they rush in and open fire. The choir stops singing, the preacher dives under the pulpit, and the congregation crouches beneath the pews as the sanctuary is sprayed with bullets. Later, at a press conference, church leaders indignantly decry the blasphemous violation of holy thresholds and sacred space. But Eugene Rivers, an African-American street pastor, offered a different and prophetic word. If the church won't go into the streets will come into the church. And then Jim Wallace goes on to say that in Palestine, 8 centuries before Christ, the prophet Isaiah delivers oracles to the children of Israel and to the neighboring Egyptians about the plight of their societies. Their land is filled with silver and gold, and there is no end to their treasures. Their land is filled with horses, and there is no end to their chariots. Their land is filled with idols. They bow down to the work of their hands, to what their fingers have made. And so the people are humbled, and everyone is brought low. The consequence, the prophet continues, of a society's greed, social injustice, and idol worship is judgment in the form of spiritual degradation, violence, and the breakup of community. The people turn on one another. And then he goes on to say that when he was talking with some Crips and Bloods in Los Angeles, he asked what the churches could do to help. And an 18-year-old gang member looked us straight in the eyes and said, "We need the churches to lead us to the Lord." I now believe that in responding to this call, the churches themselves will be led back to the Lord. The escalation of violence on our nation's streets has reached such a crisis that perhaps only the religious community can adequately respond to it. Why? Because the cruel and endemic economic injustice, soul-killing materialism, life-destroying drug traffic, pervasive racism, unprecedented breakdown of family life and structure, an almost total collapse of moral values that have created this culture of violence are at heart spiritual issues. And then a year ago, getting my progression here, there is a word from Mark Rosenberg from the Centers for Disease Control. And his title is, do you remember what his title is? I don't think it gives it here.
Director of Disease of Violence Prevention and Control.
Yeah, okay. And he's from the Centers for Disease Control. And he says that most people think that homicide is sort of accidental, that most homicide victims are people who get caught in a late-night robbery attempt that ends in a crossfire shootout at the convenience stores. And yet, when we analyze thousands and thousands of cases, we discover that this is not, in fact, the picture at all. Most homicides occur among people who know each other. They occur among friends, among acquaintances, people who argue, people who fight. They are usually in the home, not at the convenience store, not on the street, in the home. Says today's typical homicide is not felony related, it's not related to a drug deal, it's just two people who know each other, they disagree, the argument escalates, they're drinking, and alcohol is an important factor. One friend has a gun, he grabs that gun, and bam, that's your homicide. But he goes on to talk about something that's even, I mean, that's bad enough. But this is the thing that he says. We have a problem in our society that doesn't even occur in other industrialized countries. Our children are killing our children. It's horrible. It's the first time we faced it, and it's the face of this epidemic, the face of a child. Children have always fought. You know that. But now when kids fight, the fights are more likely to be fatal. That's what makes the difference. They're not fighting with fists, they're fighting with guns. Which brings us to the other critical element in this epidemic of violence. That's guns. How critical are guns? Extremely. Firearms play a central role in the escalating rates of violence. In this country, we have a vast amount of firearms. And he goes on to say we have 217 million guns. Not quite, but dangerously close to one for every man, woman, and child in this nation. So those are all very sobering things, and I think one of the issues that Rognes raised 15 years ago is what are the things that we're saying are causing this violence? And some of you would, I mean, I've already said about guns. What else do you see as possible causes?
I think a lot of anger comes from early lack of love and some kind of structure. A love that manifests itself sometimes in positive discipline. Mm-hmm. So that people don't even stop to think sometimes. They don't have that much self-discipline developed that they stop to think. Mm-hmm. Or see a larger picture.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
Well, I believe that you can't put enough emphasis on the fact that there are guns available. I think that we can talk about all kinds of reasons for violence, mm-hmm. and I think that that's acted out. There are battered children, battered women. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that though we're not unique in this country, we don't have we're no more violent probably than people in Canada, people in Australia, people in England, people in all of Europe. But the fact remains is that the homicide rate is so high here. There's only one reason for that, and that is because there are so many guns.
Well, but that's why the category. You see, my husband, who has more than one gun for hunting, and he loves, he likes to collect them. That is too simplified a reason to me. It's all right, there's a gun in the home, but the parents have not taught the children. And that to me is the breakdown of family violence. Now, the people who have guns are going to. They say, and my husband believes this, that if we make rules about guns, there still will be guns. Because guns can be brought in illegally, just as drugs can be brought in illegally. And that we can't have too simple a solution. And people can prove that he can by statistics that the rules about guns are not going to stop this violence. It's they young people have to be taught, and they should be taught that even pointing a gun at somebody playing with guns, that you never point a gun, whether it's loaded or unloaded or whatever. You don't, because you can kill with guns. Mm-hmm. And so there's this, and he says that the National Rifle Association will teach in schools, mm-hmm. that guns kill, but they don't let them have that program in the schools. So some of our educational institutions are at fault, that they will have a program in school about that, you know, that guns kill. them.
Okay. Glenn?
Yeah, I think that the dislocation in our society because of, you know, the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, I mean, it's pretty easy to document, has created some additional stresses that that I think are feeding into this. I guess I would respond, I think you're right that anybody that believes that gun control would be a panacea immediately is probably in fantasy world.
Yeah.
But
yeah. People are amazing.
Yeah. But
absolutely amazing.
And it certainly wouldn't change anything immediately.
Yeah.
But if we're having 10,000 gun murders a year, and if we saved 50 of those lives or 100 of those lives, which would be, you know, one, what is it, half of, let's see, 100 1%.
Yeah.
It would be worth it. And I think most people believe that we could probably save 1,000 or 1,500. Because your husband and people, the NRA folks, are thinking of themselves and their friends who are very careful with their guns.
Yeah.
But when you've got 200 million guns out there, you have a lot of suburban plumbers and doctors and postmen and you know, people that whose main life is directed somewhere else, and they just happen to have a gun in a drawer in the hallway in case some trouble happens. And it's interesting because the New England Journal of Medicine, which is one of the two most prestigious medical journals, had an article where, not from a crime point of view, but from a medical, epidemiological point of view, they calculated that if you have a gun in the house, it's 43 times more likely to be used against a neighbor or a family member, or some child finds it. Maybe your son's buddy, you know, grabs it and they play with it. And that, I think that's what she's talking about. It's, I don't think anybody disagrees that some training would help, but the very fact that there's a gun in a home means that it's more likely it will be toyed with. And I don't think all the training in the world will, I don't think that's the total panacea either. Maybe we need a little of both. More training if you do have a gun, but fewer guns for all of those people for whom guns just aren't going to be.
I don't think that this, it helps to have the registration and laws about the purchase of them, and that will help. But we have to be a little careful.
Reasonable.
But, yeah, that's right.
Well,
I think. I was going to say, I think his point's well taken. Being an ER nurse, that I'm very much aware of that statistic. And you know, you just to show you how skewed the thinking is sometimes. I think the person who brings the gun into the home thinks that it's somehow going to safeguard their loved one. And what they found in the study is a very, you know, telling statistic that in the reality, the chance of it being used against a loved one or your neighbor's child is so great that I think we really have to stop and rethink that. And that again is speaking to the violence, because that's why the gun was brought into the house, for fear
in the
that their personal safety was a threat. So I'm very happy that knowledge is becoming more available. It's certainly something we do with teaching, with safeguarding your home.
Do young people that are able to drive ever have a concept of the fact that a car can be a deadly weapon? Young people think this.
But they are licensed also.
And you're right. I believe in the licensing. But I think if they don't believe that a car can become a deadly weapon, I don't think it sinks into teenagers or younger people.
That a gun is also a deadly weapon.
Unless you're really high on target practice, the only thing a gun is created for
is to kill.
That's right. I mean, the kids that I know can't imagine that they can die.
Yeah.
I mean, I've read probably 300 books about young men in military, and a very common problem. I mean, the highest rate of death of soldiers is in the first month and the last couple weeks of combat, because in the first month they haven't yet figured out that it's possible to die. I mean, they know it intellectually, but they don't know it in their bones. And then at the end, they're trying to be so careful because they do know that they can die, that they make a different kind of mistakes that results in cancer. It's an interesting statistic, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that early month, it suggests some, a problem that it's better to keep the guns away from them than to believe that we could ever totally educate them to the point where they're going to be careful. There's not.
Because we already know with cars that they're not careful. Well, and part of this parish nurse thing is to raise the issues, to give you materials that you can be discussing in churches. And I'll tell you where our church has started. I go to a Catholic Lutheran church where we have a priest and a pastor, and our priest is a Franciscan priest, and he talks a lot about peace and nonviolence. And one of the first things he said in addressing the whole issue is that we need to teach our children that we have conflict in our lives, but we need to learn how to resolve that conflict so that it's peaceful and it's life-giving and does not take away lives. And so in our church, we have the Sunday school materials are built around peacemaking skills for little kids, creative conflict solving for kids, and we have one of our Sunday school teachers that has done a wonderful job of integrating this with the Sunday school materials that the children have. And then we also have a book, and I'm sorry I don't have it, but it's called Fighting Fair for Families. And that particular book, we called the entire congregation together, the children and the parents, and we talked about conflict resolution and the need to understand the rules that we have for resolving conflict. And we said that this is so important, and we really believe this is what Christ wants us to do, is to teach each other. Well, I thought it was funny because about 2 weeks after we had done this in our congregation, I taught Sunday school, and I'm just a substitute Sunday school teacher, and I walked into the six-year-old class and showed them a picture, and I said, "What do you see in this picture?" And they said, "Oh, let's see, this looks like a man coming up to an island in a boat." And I said, "Oh, that's not right at all." And I think they were shocked because they never see me as anyone that would disagree with anything. And this one little boy just immediately, he said, "Do you know the six rules for fighting fair?" And I thought, hey, these kids are taking this seriously. So just so that you know that there are materials out there that are very, very useful, and I do have a book that gives where you can write for these resources. The other thing is that Al Rognes raised the point 15 years ago is TV violence. And I just wanted to play just a segment of the Beyond Blame and violence in the media. And even though some of you were at the forum the other night where we talked about violence, some of you weren't. And this kind of, I think this gives a pretty good sweep of what happens.
It's from the killing screens.
For the first time in human history, a child is born into a home in which television is on an average of about 7 hours a day. In some countries, a little more, in some countries, a little less, but in all industrial countries, this is about the situation. And for the first time in human history, most of the stories are told not by the parent, not by the school, not by the church, not by the tribe or the community, and in many places, not even by the native country, but by a relatively small and shrinking group of global conglomerates who have something to sell. And it changes in a very fundamental way the cultural climate, the cultural environment into which our children are born, in which they grow up, in which they become socialized, in which they become human beings,
And we're going to spell out some of the consequences of that change. And we've been studying the nature of that world for many years and the consequences of growing up and living with television. But we only have time for a few highlights, a few examples, that we might start with asking the question now, what is that world like? Who are the people who animate that world? What is the cast of characters with which we grow up? Well, that cast of characters in television drama, in prime time, is essentially a very skewed, a very distorted cast. Men outnumber women about 3 to 1. By reproducing an over-representation of white males in the prime of life, television is reproducing and is appealing to its own best customers. The reason for that is not only dramatic formulas, but the reason for that is that television has to adjust to a marketing strategy in which it, in effect, has to represent, over-represent, and to a large extent flatter their best customers. So we're growing up in a world that is designed to the specifications of a marketing strategy, regardless of other conditions. And the cast that you put on the stage has a great deal to do with the kind of stories that you'll be able to tell. When you put on the stage a cast, more than half, almost two-thirds of which is white males in the prime of life, what is the kind of a story that is most likely, most easily told with that kind of a cast? Well, we find that that is a story of power.
Get out of here before I give you a smack right in the face.
There is a story of conflict. There's a story of violence, which is one reason, one of several key reasons why violence is such a prevalent, pervasive, and troubling aspect of the new world of stories and of culture in which we're born. So let's consider violence and why is it so pervasive. Many people say, well, that's what the people want, and that is because it's very popular. That is not so. Violence in itself is not a popular commodity. To be sure, there are some good stories and very strong stories that have a lot of violence, but their popularity does not rest in the violence. Most of the highly rated programs on television are non-violent.
What's going on here, Jimmy? What went wrong?
Well, you know, if you ask me, that girl's got a big problem.
You're right, it's called good taste.
Violence projects a sense of male power. Men are the producers of most of his programs, but most of all, it doesn't take great talent, it doesn't take a lot of time, it doesn't take much creativity. It can be plugged in whenever a dull program is beginning to lag. It kind of livens up, its activity livens up the program. Furthermore, it's a good commodity for the global market. And most television and most motion pictures are produced for a global market. They're not even produced for a domestic national market. They're produced for a global market. And as they say in the trade, violence travels well. You don't need to translate. More expensive to produce. It's less easy to circulate in different cultures. So that global marketing imperatives make violence an excellent commodity and inject it into our lives in a way that has never happened before. Now there may have been more bloodthirsty eras in the history of humankind, although I'm not sure about that. I'm not even sure how one would find out. But I can tell you that there has never been the amount of violent imagery that permeates every home today that we have at the present time. This is historically totally unprecedented. We are awash with a tide of violent representations such as the world has never known. And I think the consequences are very troubling.
I take exception to his word every. Every hump doesn't.
Yeah.
Did I ever use the television? And my grandchildren, if they ever watch, they have half an hour of, you can watch this for half an hour, and that's it. I really believe that, I mean, in putting the onus on the parent. But if you're poor and you don't have a babysitter after school and you must work, then you have problems. That it's difficult.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and having been an elementary, you know, middle school and high school teacher, the parent that tries to restrict by themselves is at a tremendous disadvantage. I mean, I would say that it's
easy
it's
to start
hopeless.
Out when they're, you know, when they're old enough.
But even then, it's an awful lot easier if you can get all the parents in the classroom together, or half of them. And have a little bit of support, because I remember growing up, we didn't have a TV until I was in junior high, and we would like listen in on what other people said, and then try to pretend like we'd seen it. I mean, it's just because you don't want to be left out of what people are talking about the next thing. And if the TV was on all night the night before, those kids weren't doing anything else but watching TV. There's nothing else that they can talk about the next day, because that's all that happened virtually between the time they left school and the time they came back. and if every, you know, if there's a few channels and after a while they all get to, you know, talk about the same, I mean, it takes over in the conversation of kids. And to try to go up against that, I think really requires, for most parents, I think it requires getting organized and, you know, trying to get at least a...
I think we should start challenging, you know, parents and say, if you want your child to do da-da, then you turn off the television and you can do this with them, maybe give them something, if they don't have any ideas how to replace it. But I think we should start challenging whether people have a right to have children unless they can be good parents. It really and truly.
Well, it's interesting that one of the comments that's made is that, what is it, teddy bears are under more scrutiny for whether or not they're harmful to children than any TV program is.
Right, or any weapon.
Or any weapon, right. And it's, go ahead. No, that's fine, go ahead.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed in watching people comment on TV violence is that they talk about the people that produce shows. One thing that is, I think, perpetrating violence is the amount that violent crime is covered on TV. It's always the lead story. Sometimes there are stories, maybe three or four stories on violent crime. In the face of the fact that crime and violent crime is on the decrease, I can't remember what else I was going to say, and also in face of the fact that this data published by the Center for Disease Control shows over and over and over again that most killings take place in the home. Mm-hmm. But what's portrayed is you better not go out on the streets at night. Mm-hmm. Now, I've lived in New York. I've walked around in the Harlem. Mm-hmm. I haven't felt safe all the time, but I've done it. And I've walked around in many cities in the night, and I'm still here. I've never been mugged. Mm-hmm. I know it could happen. But the thing is that the streets are not as violent as we've been led to believe.
Oh, thank you. You just played right into the... You did very well on that one. The four effects of viewing media violence is aggressiveness and antisocial behavior, which is always the one that people look at. But really, it increases the fear of becoming a victim, and you get this, what they call the mean world syndrome. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even...
suppose you watch, they say in primetime TV, you watch like 5 violent acts an hour. So if you watch 3 hours a night, you probably see about 15 violent acts. Okay, is that realistic? Do you see that many every day? You may see some though. Yeah. Okay, desensitization to violence and victims of violence. So in other words, you're less likely to be a good Samaritan. You're less likely to stop and help. And then this appetite for more violence and entertainment in real life, that was the other thing that L. Rognes had mentioned, which I thought was really interesting 15 years ago. What is even more alarming is the observation of publishers that if a book of fiction is to sell well in America, it must deal with thugs, abnormal sex, and murder. Not that thugs read books, but we who are not sex perverts want more exciting reading than Charles Dickens or Thornton Wilder. But and someone this morning said, well, yeah, I guess that if they produce a film that has 3 people shot the first time, the next time you really want to make that just a little bit better, so you have 5 people shot. And so it does kind of increase that. And one of the things that I will pass around, I know I'm awfully ambitious today to do this because I want to cover domestic violence also, because I think this is something the church needs to address. And because we had talked about TV violence the other night, I thought, well, I do have some things to pass out on that. At the end.
What you're looking for, one of the things we haven't talked about here in media violence is music, and also the music of young people. That's just not something we've touched on. Mm-hmm. But the music of some younger folk is incredibly violent and brutal. Mm-hmm. If you can listen to the words, it's very scary. And that, I just think that's part of media today.
Sure.
Also.
Sure.
This is the part that we have to accept. It's something we should be finally
be aware that it's something.
Yeah, I did it. I wouldn't have known it unless, kids at school, I heard them repeating it.
Sure.
Because, teachers can be completely insulated from the stuff.
From what is really, yeah.
If I never allowed my children to watch, I remember my grandchildren once taking them to a picnic, and the son of another teacher took out a little plastic. It was pink, even gun. Mm-hmm. And my grandchild said, "What is that?" She had never seen a gun before. And I thought, I was really proud for the moment. And I thought, can she ever protect herself if she's so innocent of violence? So it's a dilemma there.
Well, and that's one of the things with media. And that's, again, part of parish nursing is to bring to the congregations materials that they can use to open up discussion of what the congregation needs to know to protect itself. And part of media is not turning off the television, but to have media literacy. And again, when it goes back to music, what are those songs saying? Unless I have my kids interpret them for me, write down the words, I can't understand them most of the time. So then I'll ask my kids to do that, and sometimes they won't. So I go, uh-oh. But this beyond blame through media and values, and the address is here, is something that can be used in congregations. And I would like to go on, and I'm not sure if, we should just about be able to finish the segment on how the church needs to be aware of domestic violence. Again, we've mentioned how much of this happens in the home. How many churches talk about domestic violence? I went to a Hispanic church, and I must say that after, 2.5 years of parish nursing, and I said, what do you think is the main problem in your church, main health problem in your church? And the man said, alcoholism. And I said, and the second problem, he said, domestic violence. I have never heard a church say that. And I thought, wow, they're pretty aware of their problems. And it's so much easier to work with things that you're aware of, because domestic violence is probably besides alcoholism, those two things are very hidden in the church. So I would like to play a tape for you
We talk about domestic violence and what the church needs to be aware of.
If there's anything good that comes out of the OJ surface, it's that. Well, I don't think people ever talked about it very well until it came out.
Would you help me welcome Julie Owens?
And thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you about a very important subject, that of domestic violence. Just to put this in perspective for you, because we rarely see the statistics compiled in such a way, during the Vietnam War, 58,000 Americans died. During the same time period, 54,000 American women were murdered by their partners.
Here in Hawaii, Julie Owens is well known for her work on behalf of battered women. What many don't know is that Julie herself was also battered. But unlike most survivors, Julie was the daughter of a well-respected minister whose congregation gave her support and understanding.
Nobody in the church or otherwise identified me as an abused woman. It's because I wasn't getting hit. I wasn't getting beat up. What was happening, though, was I was being isolated. I was being verbally abused. I was being harassed, kept up at night.
There is never, never an excuse for physical or emotional violence.
Everybody I talked to, from doctors to the minister who married us, to counselors, all had some reason why he was being the way he was. None of it being the fact that he was making a choice. But usually it centered around his problems with alcohol.
If you did this while you were drunk, then your responsibility is you shouldn't turn to drinking in the first place as a way to solve it. There is never an excuse for violence.
And people would say to me, he loves you so much. The way he looks at you, my friends were actually envious of me because of how much he adored me. But they didn't see the other side of him. They didn't see when I was sitting in church with his arm around me, that his other hand was reaching around and pinching me with his fingernails in the side throughout the sermon.
Finally, one night, he threatened her life. And she called us the next day and said, I need to come home.
It wasn't very long after that one night he woke me up in the middle of the night and he had a loaded gun. And he had it pointed at his chest, and he said, I'm going to kill myself now. And that was because I had said the night before, I can't live like this, I'm leaving.
Of the women who are killed because of domestic violence, 75% of them are killed when they leave their partner.
She was in greatest danger because, number one, we had asked him to leave our home, and number two, she had informed him that she was filing for divorce.
I arrived there with my baby in the car, asleep in his little car seat, and it happened so quickly, and it was so frightening that I just screamed. And it was my husband. He had a knife in one hand. He started beating me up with the other hand, punching me, swearing at me, smashing my face.
It was all well planned. He pulled the phones from the wall.
I didn't know what he wanted. And he said, I'm going to kill your father. Where's your father?
As soon as I opened the door, she screamed.
My husband went running out, screaming, I'm going to kill you.
Came at me with a knife and attacked me.
I was trying to hold my husband back.
And he said, I'm going to cut your eyes out.
He turned around and stabbed me in the abdomen. I didn't even know it at the time. I screamed, Daddy's going to kill you.
Made a large slash at my eye.
He was going, my eyes are gone. And I thought they were, and he thought they were, because his forehead was hanging down over his eyes.
Fortunately, I was able eventually to succumb him, but...
He took a look at us and what he had done, and he ran. The church was just absolutely shocked. They couldn't believe that this nice guy had done this to their pastor and to his daughter, because they knew us. They had known us for years, and they loved us. They knew we were good people. And I think on some level, it just completely blew away all their stereotypes about the fact that victims must provoke the violence.
The first Sunday that I was back in the church, that I was in the pulpit, I shared what we had learned.
Let us talk about painful things to open the eyes of others.
The God we worship is the God who is always on the side of those who suffer unjustly, the victims of abuse, the harassed, the helpless, the oppressed. Until, you know, my daughter and I became convinced that I had never even referred to domestic violence in a sermon.
The Good Samaritan, we pass by. So let us commit ourselves to the task of exposing and opposing domestic violence, abuse in all of its forms, by helping to free them from abusive relationships, by providing safe houses for homeless women and children, by educating ourselves to the issues as a congregation, and by becoming doers of the word and not hearers only, as Jesus said. Let us pray.
I think my father changed a lot as a result of this experience.
Nothing fires my indignation more than to hear of a woman who has stayed in an abusive relationship because a pastor has said it is God's will for you to stay in this relationship.
And I think he learned that women who've been abused, if they go into marriage counseling with their pastor, they can't tell the truth. If they tell the truth, they get hurt. If they don't tell the truth, the marriage counseling doesn't do any good. So now he doesn't recommend marriage counseling.
The kind of training that I received and the kind of training that most pastors, I believe, are still receiving does not equip them to deal with issues like domestic violence.
And I think most of all now he's got a real value for safety, and his value no longer is simply saving the relationship or restoring the marriage. It is a value, but the bigger goal in his counseling is stopping the violence and calling the abuser to account.
People are quick to quote scripture. Malachi, for example, God hates divorce, but God hates abuse. In fact, I think God hates abuse more.
I think that we have a long way to go to figure out how we can respond to batterers, because the church is always wanting to jump over a few steps and to forgive and to bring reconciliation. And we need to learn that we have to be harder than that, that we have to be confrontive, that we have to hold accountable.
I really believe that when you are born again, you have a new nature and God can change things within you. But what I didn't know was God will not. God's a gentleman and he won't barge in on your life. And unless this person really wanted God to change them, there would be no change. I didn't know there was such thing as false repentance.
That tears of remorse don't mean anything unless there is a genuine effort to change and evidence that change has happened. Then after that, we can talk about forgiveness and reconciliation.
What keeps batterers from changing is that no one holds them accountable. Everyone keeps blaming the victims. But once they're held accountable and batterers understand that, they're quite capable of changing.
It was a consistent batterer. And the man had the nerve to come to me and say, because she had left, that I should go and tell her to come back to him. That was my job as a priest. And I said, my job as a priest is to tell you that you have messed up your marriage and you have killed the marriage. And my job as a priest is to tell her to seek life and not death.
As clergy, it is our responsibility to help battered women and batterers in three ways. The first way is that we need to provide safety for the victims and the children through using community resources. Secondly, we have a responsibility to call the abuser to account, to make it very clear to him that it is not acceptable that this behavior continue. Thirdly, then, if we've accomplished goal one and goal two, safety and accountability, then sometimes restoration is possible within that relationship. If restoration is not possible because the damage has simply been too great, then our job is to help those members of that family really mourn the loss of those relationships so that each of them can move on in their lives and find the individual healing that they deserve.
I said, Pastor, that man has been born again and washed in the blood more times than I care to count. But I understand where you're coming from. His salvation is extremely important to you. So you know what? You and God work on his salvation without me. I'm out of here. That man has done things to me that are absolutely evil, things I cannot repeat to you, I would not dare repeat to you. And I left. And so for a year I had no church.
Our church had never...
I don't find many pastors that want to use this
in their church. I showed it to a couple pastors, and one said, well, I'm in a situation right now in the congregation that's a domestic violence situation, and I'm afraid that if I show it in the church, it might they might think that I'm just showing it for them. And I said, well, if one out of every four women is a victim of domestic violence and you point that out right away, maybe they'll realize that there are a few more people that need help. But I've got an easy out for pastors that are not willing to do that, and that's that I say to pastors, if you are unwilling to talk openly in your congregation, then there's nothing easier than having a video do it for you. I think it's really hard to be the person standing up there saying this is a problem. But these are cards that you can leave in the women's bathrooms. This one happens to be Portland Metropolitan Area Family Violence Referrals. And I said, at least acknowledge that there's a problem in your church. At least leave these out someplace where a woman can stick this in her pocket, in her purse or her pocket, that she knows where she can go for help. But help them at least that much. And I'm beginning to see more and more of these cards that are available in churches. I think that's a cop-out, because I think it's a problem that needs to be talked about. And I guess in the Mormon church and really fundamentalist churches, that I was pretty impressed in a national teleconference where a Mormon spoke up and said that his father was an alcoholic and his mother was a victim of domestic violence, and she went to the church. And the men in the church went to the home and talked to the father. He says, my father no longer beats my mother. He has joined the church and he goes to AA meetings. And I've also heard of fundamentalist churches. And I'm not sure why that isn't happening in more mainstream churches. I really can't account for that. And I guess that it does show that there's more than one way to deal with this, because our usual advice to a woman is get out of the situation. And that's probably pretty good advice. But there must be other ways of dealing with this. Yes.
I like what they said there about directing them to someone who is trained to help them.
Mm-hmm.
Some preachers are trained in it, some
aren't. True.
If they need a good therapist, that's where they should be.
That's right. Yes, thank you. I have quite a few... this is... a newsletter out of the Carter Center that talks about faith and health, and this particular issue deals with violence. I have some facts about violence for you to take. Let's see, maybe we can just pass these around. If there are any of these resources, the video, the last video that I showed was called Broken Vows, and that comes out of Seattle. And there's an address here, and the video before is the Beyond Blame. Every October in Portland, Parish Nursing, the Northwest Parish Nurse Ministries has an annual conference. And last year we did our conference. This is our conference book. It's called Breaking the Cycle of Violence. And so we brought people that talked about ways that violence is being addressed in the Northwest. And one of the things that was mentioned was that the Virtues Guide. And I don't know if any of you have ever come across this, but it's you call forth the virtues that children already have, so that if you see someone, a child displaying some courage, you mention that to them. You try to build them up. This helps to build up their self-esteem. What I like about this is I found that they have little cards that you can put in your pocket that name 52 virtues. And as I would correct papers of high school kids and things that they would say in their papers, I would try to mention the virtue that I saw in what they were writing about. And it really did seem to open up some discussion that I hadn't known would be opened up. But you might want to look through this. There was just a training in Portland about 3 weeks ago in the virtues. And they're beginning to use this. Actually, I guess the schools in British Columbia use the virtues throughout the curriculum, which I think is interesting. So any of these resources that you would like to look through, are available to you. So, thank you for coming.